All right, back again for more writer stuff tonight. Jeff Circle, as always, is with me. How are you doing, Mr. Circle?
Hey, everybody, doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
And with us is Simon Gervais, the man needs no introduction whatsoever. Prolific thriller writer, master of, and I'm not just saying this, but master of action. Like, just I have questions about tempo and some other stuff we'll get into later. But I also, given the group that's sitting here, we've got three guys here that have been intelligence field, law enforcement field, anti-terrorism, drug work. I think you guys are intelligence, counterintelligence. I think you guys are perfectly suited for this question. Why didn't either of the three of us ever pitch to our bosses the idea of a 15-year plan to explode pagers throughout a terrorist organization? Either one of you, go ahead and take that.
Yeah, probably because that would be considered terrorism. So, that's right in the line. Right? I'm not sure what people think about this or not. Really, I've been really down to my things in the last few days. I know what's happening. I guess I have my own opinions. I always try to stay off politics when I talk publicly because I don't want to antagonize anyone. And really, the truth is, I'm a swing voter. I'm going to vote my conscience on every election. I'm going to vote for the guy or the woman who I believe is going to represent my interests the best. So I'm not a left. I'm not on the right either. I'm really on the middle, depending on the issues. But that's still a good question. And you know what? I don't know what the law is about that. I'm pretty sure that in Canada, if I would have pitched an idea like this, I would be out of a job within the next minute.
Yeah, that's not something we could do in America. But the thought process, you guys have all been in those meetings being like, here's our target. How do we get to them? Like in our case, we're like our how to get to them is not how to shoot a hellfire at them, but how do we put them in handcuffs and prosecute them?
Right.
But the ideas, like, you guys have all been in the meetings where we're like, how do we get these guys? Let's get creative. Put your thinking caps on. I never in a million years would have thought to have a 15-year plan. Like, that's some Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare stuff. I just is there a crazy idea that you guys have had pitched during an operation that actually they were like, yeah, that sounds great. That's nuts, but it's great.
I think what's the most surprising to me, it was that it was never leaked out, because this is a massive operation that a lot of people knew about, or probably not massive amount of people, but enough, in my opinion, especially span on so many years. How did people didn't know about that? You know, how were they able to keep this stuff secrets? For me, it's like it's a great intelligence job, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's the thing that gets me is 15 years of OPSEC. It's nuts. Go ahead, Jeff. What are you saying?
Unbelievable OPSEC, because I was going to say the I don't want to say that the laws of warfare have necessarily changed, but I think the it's shifted over the years, especially in the last 20 years of the GWAT and the global war on terrorism. I remember Desert Storm, being in Desert Storm, and everything being very conventional. When I went to Afghanistan many years later, however, I realized real quick that things had changed a lot. And I remember one specific mission we went on for a number of months. I was part of a Red Cell team. It was a counterintelligence Red Cell team where we would show up on a FOB somewhere. We'd fly in, and the only people who knew we were there were the intel people. And that OPSEC was important too. It had to last just a couple days, and they couldn't keep that quiet for the most part. Everyone kind of knew, we were there to do something. But the thing that really stood out was just how creative can I get on the red team to do something that they're not expecting. And once you take that clamp off and you give someone the freedom of go, there are a lot of things that are possible. And it's really exciting. It's really neat to see that happen. And hopefully it will give us as writers even more freedom and ideas to think, wow, we might not be able to pitch this in a mission brief, but we can put this in a book.
We can, but I think sometimes as writers, we also need to be careful not to make our characters look like the people they want to fight, right? That's something sometimes when I go outside the box and I write a book where my, let's say my Clayton White or Caspian Anderson shoots someone in the head and it didn't have to, my editor is going to come in and say, is that really what you want to do? So sometimes I kind of rethink everything and I try to make it more, I try not to shoot people for nothing in my books. Of course, it's going to happen once in a while, but it brings me back to what you were saying, Jeff, is that it gives us idea, but sometimes we need a little bit of restraint and not go completely out there. So people will actually believe what we're writing about, but also they won't see us as the bad guys.
Well, I'm really curious then, Simon, what do you think of Jack Reacher and the character that, you know, Lee Child and Andrew have where they've taken him, and especially in the Netflix series, he will just, I mean, it gets kind of raunchy with, you know, the lines that they've crossed. He's been successful.
Of course he's been successful. And it's not a lot of people will be successful even if they go overboard. It's for me as a writer, and my publishing team, we've kind of come to an agreement about the type of books that I'm going to write. It's okay to have killing, a little bit of gore, but not too much. If it's like just blood flowing everywhere, it's not going to fit my style or the style that my publisher wants to push book out. So I need to be careful. I need to be not careful, but mindful about this, right? In the end, it's my book. They're going to put out what I want, but I don't want to antagonize anyone. As for a question about Reacher, I haven't read all the books. I haven't read the last one that Andrew wrote, but I've always been a fan. I've been a fan of the man because it took him quite a long time to be successful. You know, he used to be, I took it maybe half a dozen book to be successful. So I admire him. And what they did with the TV series, I know a lot of people say it's overboard, it's unrealistic. Of course, it's unrealistic. It's a TV show. Yeah. But the question is it entertainment? Is it entertaining? And when me, my wife, and my two kids watch the show and we enjoy it as a family, for me, it's mission accomplished.
Well, and that brings up a good question of, you know, the conflict we always need in our characters is, you know, the good guys, we need to push our protagonist as far as they can, because violence for the sake of a good page turner would take away from the decision and the crisis of conscience that you have to push your character right up to. And when you forget about that, like John Wick's amazing, love him, love watching it. It's like a roller coaster for 2 hours. But is there ever a question that, you know, okay, the dog dying is gonna pull a tear, but for the rest of it is like, is he being pushed as a character? Right? Is there other than take, how many bullets can he take? Right? That's
I think it's about your target audience and what either the producer, the network, or the publisher wants to accomplish with that movie. You know, John Wick is awesome. I think that's why the series is so popular, but it's not a movie you're gonna watch and say, my God, this movie changed my life. You know, it's a fun movie. You go to theater, 2 hours later, you don't even think about it until the next movie comes up and you buy the tickets. But I don't think their objective is to change someone's perspective about violence or anything like that.
It may not change my life, but it changed my gun safe. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
You buried in the floor now with all your gold, all your gold medallions.
My coins. Hey, Simon, you brought up something really, really interesting. When you mentioned about how it took 6 books to become successful, and the same is true of Mark Greene, just about, you know, his first books were, you know, well received, but then it wasn't until later that he really took off. And a lot of writers who are well-established writers are like you, and that's what I think, you know, this is going to be for you, you know, great books, and then bam, you got one that really takes off. And that's what the Elias Network is in my mind. But how fair do you think it is now with the publishing industry and how it's changed and how it's constantly evolving, with certain writers, good writers who've written good books, only getting a small chance of maybe one book deal or two book deals? You know, and they're on their fourth book, or and they just don't get the chance to get to that sixth book to really take off. I mean, what's happening? What can writers who are listening to writer stuff right now do if they're struggling or if they're down or if they're concerned about, is someone going to give me a chance to really break out?
I think there's two point of view. All right. There's the point of view that a lot of people say it's the best time ever to be a writer. Okay. If you want to believe that, fine. Perfect. You know, live your fantasy. My personal opinion is that it's extremely competitive and it's very hard right now to break through. And I'll tell you why this is. In my opinion, when Mark and Lee Child started, there weren't 12,000 books being published every day on Amazon. Yeah. Like everybody publishes a book now and boom, it's gone. There's the natural selection of the books are done further down the production chain, all right? Before you wrote a book, everybody wrote a book. Then you went with an agent. And then the agent tried to sell it. And then the publisher, once they bought your book, they decided which one they were going to give co-op money to the bookstore to have your books in front. And these ones were going to be successful because when people walk into bookstore, that's all they saw. And Barnes & Noble and the other controlled everything about the book market. So it was the competition was to get an agent and then to get a publisher. And once you were there, there was a chance that you were going to make a good living out of it. It was not a guarantee, of course, but there was a chance. Nowadays, people are impatient. They don't want to go through the traditional method because I don't know why, but they want to do their own thing. And it's good because it gives you power to do whatever you want. And I'm not judging which way is the best. The question was, what's happening? Well, what's happening is as there's 12,000 people or maybe AI write the books. I don't know that's being published. So there's a finite market of people that can read because now we're competing against YouTube, against Netflix, against Amazon mm-hmm. Prime, against social media. You know, there's a lot of good content being created. So it's extremely difficult right now to push through and to get your book noticed. Even if you are the best writer, how do you get noticed when you're competing against thousands of other people that wrote a book similar to you? So people get, you know, they don't get the patience of querying an agent because they don't want to wait a year or two like we did, like I did when I started. They want to say, no, my stuff is good enough. I'm going to put it out there. It's fine. Put it out there. Put money behind it. And maybe you'll get successful. But with so many books appearing on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever online every day, that's what's going on. It's extremely difficult. People wonder, help me get marketing. Help me with publicity. Well, you're going to need a lot of money to bring your book forward to beat all these other people you're competing with. So I think this is what changed is that before that, it was the publisher who was kind of deciding who was being successful. And now they are competing against so many people that unless you're one of the big name authors like the one you mentioned, and I don't consider myself one of them, I need to write good books every day. My name alone is not recognized enough to be it's a guaranteed bestseller. It's not. I need to write good books because if I have a few fail in a row, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna disappear. So this is the market right now. It's hard. There's no easy way. Steve Barry told me when I started in the business back in 2014, he told me in publishing, you need three things to be successful. You need talent. That's a given. You need your network. You need contacts. You need to go to these conferences. You need to meet people and look at them in the eyes and talking with them. And third, you need luck. You need to be at the right place, at the right moment, with the right book.
Yeah, that is the clip right there. That is fantastic.
when you made that decision, I don't know if you were always a writer or if it, you know, you're walking around since you were 12 with a notebook in your hand. But when you made the decision that you were going to go be a pro, did you lay out a business plan or did you just kind of charge ahead?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a lot of very, very good question, actually, because a lot of people say writing is art. It is art, okay? There's a lot of artful people that's going to push books like many a years, and they won't concentrate really on their craft, and they're just hoping to throw stuff on the wall and it's going to stick, right? And they don't want to listen to people say, you need to get better. You need to improve this or improve that, or that's not going to work. For me, it's never been a problem because I was receptive to the critiques. And to answer your question, I've always looked at publishing and writing as a business, not as an art form. I got into it because I wanted to be successful. For me, there was no doubt that's why, that's where I wanted to go. As you can probably see or hear from my accent, I'm a French Canadian. I barely speak English at home. I live in Ottawa, but my kids are Francophone. My wife is Francophone. I write in English. I write better than I actually speak because I can take the time to write proper grammar and everything. When I speak, sometimes it's not the same. But all this to say that if I looked at writing as an art, I would have written in French. Okay, I would have written in French for the market in Quebec and hopefully in France. But I look at the numbers, right? And a bestseller in Quebec and my province, if I was going to write in French, is 2,500 copies in a year. You're considered a bestseller and you'll go on shows. I sold more than 2,500 books today because my market, I went to the United States, England, Australia, the Anglo part of Canada. Because when I looked at it, I looked and I say, where is my biggest market? Well, my biggest market is in the United States because the type of book that I write is high action thriller. And Canadians usually don't like that stuff as much as Americans do. So when I started it, I say, I'm going to write and I'm going to write for an American market. This is how I started. So for me, it was business from the moment I started. Of course, there were adjustments I needed to make because my first book, The Thin Black Line, at the beginning, I wrote as a Canadian protagonist. My agent thought it was great and he tried to sell it to publisher. And a lot of publishers came back and say, I don't think a Canadian protagonist is going to sell. Can you change it? And I did. A lot of people will say, no, it's my book. You know, I absolutely want it to be a Canadian, or I want it to be a Mexican, let's say for it's a Mexican author. The thing is, it's fine if that's what you want to do, but don't get upset at the market that's telling you that's not what we want to read. So I think this is another problem. People don't want to listen to what the market is.
Yeah, they don't. You know, they don't study the battleground. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, John, I think you and I need to get together and co-write a cozy and market it to Canada.
I have two cats that will model for the cover. I'll tell you that right now.
We'll put a pizza box on the cover and it'll sell 2,500 copies, be a bestseller.
Yeah, but that's Simon, when you say that, you mentioned not understanding, not writing for the market, like having that goal in mind. Like for some, it's holy crap, I wrote a book. This is amazing. People are gonna love it. And they don't do any research on what is actually selling, what's the state of the publishing industry? What are the rules of the road? And they just jump in, and then you'll be at a book expo with somebody that's sitting at the table and they're pissed because they're like Jeff's saying, their cozy little romance novel about a cat who runs a pizza shop isn't selling. And you're like, you're not here to sell books right now. You're here to meet people. You're here to network. You're here to establish yourself and just enjoy the community. Because I mean, this is the whole reason I started writer stuff is because, our community is, frankly, it was shocking to me the amount of support you get from other writers. People who've never met, you meet and they're just nothing but encouragement. There is none of that, put your shock plate from your vest to the rear because you got a blade coming between your shoulder blades, like other industries I've seen.
There's something to be said about that look, like there's the three of us, we all have a similar background. And when I go to with my friends at Thriller Fest of Baltricon, there are a lot of guys that are like us. They're former law enforcement, former intelligence officers, a lot of people have different backgrounds, right? But I think we all have the same mindset because we write the same type of book. And usually people that write these type of are the people I'm going to connect with on a personal level. So how can I be an antagonist to you if you're the type of guy I'd like to be friend with, right? So you kind of support each other. But even then, there's kind of something that you need to respect, though, is that something that I notice is that sometimes you, my suggestion to writer is always try to find a group of people that are at the same level that you are right now in your career. Because they will be the one with the same struggle that you have. Like, for example, somebody that's trying to sell his book to an agent right now, he comes to talk to me. We're not going to have the same struggle. My struggle is not about finding representation or a publisher. It's about how to write the next big book, how my contract is going to come up. What should I do? How many books ahead do I need to plan? It's just a different, it's not more advanced. It's just at a different level. And sometimes I think people try to go maybe 2-3 notch too high too soon, and they don't learn what they should learn. They're learning stuff that's going to come in 5-6 years for them. They should have a group of friends that's going to stick with, and they're going to grow together in the industry, and they're going to help each other. I think this is the place, like Trailer Fest and Boucher, these are the places where you can do these type of things, where you can start the bonding, the friendship with the other writers.
Well, and, I think and that's the history great. Of that. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's great. That's been fantastic for me. I mean, we're all together because of, you know, not only because, you know, Simon's a great writer, but because we've all met, and that really goes a long way. And I've noticed that in the dossier, I've got 125 people in there, and I can reach out to any of them. Even there are, most of them are, you know, well above me in publishing, but still it's nice to be able to reach out and say, hey, will you read a chapter for me and give me some pointers? So, Simon, real quick. We have a few minutes left. I want people to know about the Elias Network. I'm just going to read two things real quick. Simon Gervais is a true master of action and intrigue. Nobody, and that's in capital letters, nobody does it better. Mark Greene. And Secrets, Lies, and Wall-to-Wall Action. The Elias Network is a master class in globetrotting international intrigue. Simon Gervais brings his A game and then takes it to an entirely new level. Absolutely riveting. Brad Thor, two of the biggest, most successful thriller writers in America and in the world today, have said that about this book. So how did you come up with this? And I don't mean like the boring, how did you come up with the story, but how did you make the leap from what you mentioned earlier with the Clayton White series to something like this, where the biggest thriller writers in the world are saying this is incredibly amazing? And I think these blurbs are for real.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate the kind words. I think it's experience. It's like any other job, right? You get better. And I take critique well as well. So I've been lucky since my four books. So for me, my breakthrough novel was Hunt Them Down. That came up. That first of my Pearson came out in January 2019. That was my breakthrough novel. And since then, I've worked with the same editor for all of my books. So this is very special. And I've learned a lot from my editor at Thomas & Mercer. I do read the comments and read and the lines. So I think I just got better. And the edits are getting easier and easier as I progress in my career. And I think that's why this book might be better than the other in some ways, because it didn't take me longer to write it. It just came easier. It flows better. And I understand how to pit people against each other in writing, how to play with the emotions, how to write good action scenes that are not necessarily over the top. I think that's why. I think I kind of found my groove, what I'm good at, and I'm just concentrating on it.
Yeah, that go ahead, Jeff. Did you have a follow up? Sorry, I jumped the mic.
No, I got you.
I am one of those nerds who likes to know where the story comes from. So I do have a follow up. But yeah, when you're writing, you know, a high action thriller, over your number of books you've written, the tempo of a book, like the build up, the fight scene, then the build up to the next and the build up to the next. Have you noticed that you've changed the way you pace a book over time, or has that evolved at all? Or do you just kind of write and it's like, this has been too slow, I'm going to go fight. And then you go back to building. Like, how organized are you as far as strategically outlining your book?
Right. I used to be a pantser for my Pearson series. I didn't know where I was going. I was just going. And I realized it was taking me so long to write the book because I'm sure you guys know sometimes you write yourself in a corner and it's very difficult to come back out of it, especially when you have a looming deadline coming at you. When I wrote for a Robert Ludlum estate, The Blackbriar Genesis, I had to write two books in a year and I knew I couldn't afford to get lost. So I did a huge outline. And since then, I'm sold on writing big outlines. Like I'm going to write 14,000 to 15,000 words outline now. I'm going to do all the twists and turns, all the action scene. I'm going to add a little bit of dialogue. So I know I'm not going to get lost. So for me to write a synopsis of about 15,000 words, going to take me a few months, going to take me maybe 2-3 months. Then to write the book, it's going to take me less time than it took me to write the synopsis, because you just need to add, you know, the stuff around the synopsis. So I don't know if it's my process. I think my process got better because I'm outlying. But to answer your question about how did I come up with the Elias Network, it's really, I was looking back at my previous books and what type of heroes did I use? You know, there was a ex-DEA guy, there was an ex-Army Ranger, Secret Service guy. So I said, okay, what can I do that's not being overdone, or at least that I didn't do? And I said, what about, you know, an assassin that in fact doesn't even work for the US government? He thinks he does, but he doesn't. And make him not lame a little bit, but boring, right? So I wanted it to be boring at the beginning, like the type of guy that seems that he doesn't know what he's doing, but he does know what he's doing. But to the outside person, he just looked like a regular Joe that's a little bit clumsy. So I guess that's why I came back from. I looked at my other books and I said, okay, I've never done an assassin, so I'm going to do that.
Okay, yeah, that kind of answered my question, because as I was reading, you know, we got Caspian and we got Lizelle.
Yeah, perfect.
Lizelle. Okay, I got it. But my question was, as I'm watching, you know, this build, I was wondering like who came first, Caspian or Lizelle? Cause I was, you know, that for me, it usually starts with character, you know? So I was just wondering, and I think he answered it. Yeah. You want to try something else?
Yeah. Caspian did come first. It did come first because I'm going to write a male protagonist. I don't think I'm talented enough to write a female protagonist and like a first person type of thing, but Caspian came first and then I needed to find a lot of interest. And I thought it added depth to have somebody that's from Europe, you know, that's from a friendly intelligence service, because as you guys know, there's a lot of inter-rivalry, right? When we like, there's a lot of industrial espionage that's being done in the United States. The French are doing it. We're doing it to the French, Italian, and everything. So I said, I'm going to bring that in because I don't think it's being overdone in the market right now, like these type of competing within allies. So that's what I did. And I'm glad it came together nicely like it did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always, I love the idea of a good industrial espionage team. Like, you know, because I think people will get the international, transnational espionage, but when you got somebody just trying to steal product, I think there's a lot to do there. I've had too many other things I wanted to write, so I haven't gotten to it. I just love that idea. But no, it's, I think we've kept you for a bit. So, Jeff, you got anything else? Because I do have one more question that I do.
I just want to say, hey, we're looking forward to the Elias Enigma coming in 2025.
Right. It's going to come in July. It's going to be a big summer book.
Fantastic.
July 2025.
Awesome. Can't wait.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. My reading got a little mixed up this week because I lost power on Thursday and I didn't get power back till Sunday. So I was entertaining two little boys more than I was sitting quietly reading. There was none of that for the weekend. And you know, thoughts out for everybody in Asheville and everybody else that's suffering because of the hurricane. Hoping for the best. But before I let you go, I have a question that I've asked everybody who's come around that's got a service background. You've lived a servant's life, law enforcement, anti-terrorism, infantry. So the question I have for you, for any, you know, 17, 18-year-old kid watching now, like trying to figure out, high school's coming to an end, trying to figure out what to do with their lives. They walk past a recruiter's office. What advice do you have for them?
I think you need to do something that you want to do. I've talked to this with my wife quite a lot, and we actually met when we were in the military. I was an infantry officer. My wife was a dentist in the army. And we often talk about this and say, I believe it would serve the public well in our country if everybody had to do 12 to 24 months of military service. I think it would show respect, and people would understand a lot more thing about the world than when they don't even consider that type of career. A lot of people complain about the military and law enforcement, and I know it's not an easy choice, it's not an easy career, but it's extremely rewarding at the same time. So if you have a little bit of interest, I would highly suggest you walk into that recruiting center and talk to a recruiter, because there's hundreds of jobs you can do in the Navy and the Air Force and the Army and the Coast Guard, or even as a federal law enforcement officer, or even as a city cop. I mean, there's a lot of things that you will find something you will like to do in the military. So I would say if you feel like it, absolutely walk into it. I mean, it's a great career.
Yeah, great. Yes, nailed it. I totally agree. But yeah, especially if everybody had to learn, if everybody had the same, you know, suffering but also rewarding experience, the community, regardless of what nation you're serving under, the community would be served better overall if everybody had the same experience.
I think I became a better person being in the military, because you become less selfish. You think about your group, not only about yourself. And it kind of goes back a little bit to what you were saying earlier about why the thriller writer community is good, because a lot of people have that background, or their parents were, and they told them about how it is. Like you mentioned Brad Thor earlier, I know his father was a Marine. So of course he understand that concept. And a lot of people do. And I think that's why we're all on friendly terms. It's because of this. We're not as selfish as other people are. That's my personal thought.
Yeah. Yeah. You learn to work as a team. It's important, but no, I think that's great advice. And I hope there's a 17 or 18 year old out there listening that takes it. So, but, fellas, I can't thank you enough, Simon, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Honestly, guys, it's been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup, mon frère.
Oh, ça me fait plaisir.
There's always an open invitation to return.
Sound good, guy. Take care.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.